Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started here momentarily. Our next panel is Border Security, Intelligence, and Information Sharing. Again, this is to this audience here. Everyone understands and appreciates the impact of border security and the complexity of border security. It's not just the land borders, but it's also the maritime borders. It's guarding against terrorism and smuggling, but it's also dealing with issues like human trafficking. So it's a whole variety, very broad range of issues and very complex. Throughout our history of border security, we've undergone a series of changes the way we've approached it. A lot of debate throughout government on Capitol Hill about how do you do that? Do you do that with fences? Do you do that with technology? Do you do that with people? Well, one of the areas that we think going forward that really deserves a critical issue is how do you use information in helping to provide a security to the border areas of the United States? And as we transition into this risk-based security model, in fact, I would argue it's one the department has always wanted to embrace but hasn't been able to due to the political climate and also having unlimited resources, so we're going to be forced into a risk-based security model. A risk-based security model is inherently an intelligence and information-driven model. You can't do risk-based security without intelligence and information sharing. So we are thrilled to have a very distinguished panel here today to talk about this issue. First and foremost, we have Chief Fisher. Usually we have someone of Chief Fisher's stature up here speaking by himself without other people. So he graciously said, no, I'm okay. I can wedge myself in between you other folks and provide value. So we appreciate his willingness to do that and to add value to this discussion. But Chief Mike Fisher is currently the Chief of the Border Patrol. He's responsible, obviously, for all aspects of that planning, organizing, coordinating, and directing our nation's enforcement efforts. He's been with the Border Patrol since 1987, and he's been in his current position since May of 2010. So, Chief Fisher, we're thrilled to have you here. Next to Chief Fisher, we have Don Bowers. He's the Assistant Vice President and Chief Technology Officer for SAIC. He's been with SAIC for 16 years, and he's a subject matter expert in the area of cyber and information security, engineering, and operations, so a true technical expert. And he works within SAIC to develop cybersecurity architecture, design, and engineering, which are all critical, obviously, to information sharing and utilization. Next, we have a repeat offender at CSIS, Bob Mockney, who we're always delighted to have here for his unique programs that he's responsible for operating. He's director of the U.S. Visit Program, Visitor and Immigrant Status Indicator Technology Program, as part of the NPPD, National Protection and Programs Directed at U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Bob has been in this position for how many years now? About 10. So he's a few people, I would argue, if anyone understands the issue of the immigration and that Bob, like Bob does. We also have Josh Cushman. Josh Cushman is a senior vice president at the Sentinel HS Group, where he leads this firm's border security practice. He is also a senior affiliate here at CSIS. And then last but not least, batting cleanup, we are absolutely thrilled to have Eileen Lawrence. Eileen is Director of the Homeland Security and Justice Issues at GAO, Government Accountability Office, where she focuses on issues of information sharing. And interestingly enough, we had a conversation. We wanted someone from GAO to be here, and they have someone who does border and someone who does information. So the question was, who was going to be the right person to come to this? I'm not sure if Eileen got the short straw or the long straw, but she's graciously offered to be here, and we really appreciate that. So we'll get right to the remarks. Each of the panelists will do 5 minutes, and then we'll get to or long. If they so, and then we'll get into questions and answers, and we really thank all the panelists. So, Chief Fisher, over to you, sir.
Thank you, Rick. First of all, it's a true opportunity and a privilege to be here, and I look forward to the discussion and dialogue. And to be true to the no more than 5 minutes, as I look out in the audience, I see a lot of familiar faces, and with information being one of our pillars one of three pillars, the other two being information integration and rapid response of our strategy that was rolled out this past May. One of the recent questions that I've been getting lately is, okay, so what's happening now? As part of our implementation process, I won't bore you with the details. I thought I'd share with you an unclassified version of an incident that happened last night in South Texas during our intel brief this morning. Because I think for me, as many of you may have known, our South Texas campaign, which was launched, designed, and implemented in last year, was really the precursor, kind of our first out-the-door experiment as we were finishing up and fine-tuning the national strategy. And if you've had the opportunity to go down there, I'd certainly encourage you to do so, because that, over the next 5 years, is really going to shape the manner in which we, at least within CBP and in particular the Border Patrol, look at corridors and the way that we protect this country. So last night in the Intel Ops Center, Border Patrol agents received a call from an individual within the community with some information. Now, this gets to the difference between community relations and what we're calling in the strategy community engagement. So somebody in the community recognizing what was suspicious based on the outreach provided some level of information. So the Intelligence and Operations Center, during some of their joint targeting teams, identified some potential areas where this activity may be happening. That information was then launched to an asset for overhead surveillance, and the asset was able to identify smuggling activities along the border, across the river in particular, 30 individuals loading what appeared to be narcotics into a pickup truck. At that point, the reconnaissance continued, led the vehicle to a house. Outside perimeter was set, we worked with investigators, et cetera, went in with the warrant, and made the seizure, made a few arrests. What happened then was a series of specific debriefs, much like the DOD has perfected over the years in the F3EAD environment. Again, Border Patrol within the strategy is trying to understand and how we do intelligence to not just to drive the operations, but to set the operational tempo. So what we were able to find out that was only partial load. The rest of the load in a bunker in Mexico and a couple different addresses, that information was then provided from our Mexican liaison over to our counterparts, both with SSP, the Federal Police, and SEDENA, the Mexican military, that's working in coordinated fashion in the same high-risk identified areas and was ready to respond to our calls also as we're doing this more and more frequently across the southwest border. So the asset goes back up and provides overwatch capability. The Mexican counterparts on the south side hit the house and made additional arrests and additional seizures. So the whole idea of information integration and rapid response, as it looks at the new way that we look at border security, again, from a very whole-of-government, holistic approach, and how we just don't continue to look at information and intelligence on reporting historical things that have happened in the past, which is, in law enforcement, in my experience, pretty much the norm. And so this is a transition. So if you're interested in future implementation and what it looks like, welcome those discussions and questions as well. So thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Chief. We appreciate those remarks. And then we're going to go to the Chief Technology Officer, who has multiple technology devices in front of him.
How about that? All right. So I was asked to I'm sort of a multidisciplined guy, and so I was asked to come up and talk about information sharing. And as I was listening to the chief, it harkened me back to the day when I actually was in law enforcement. And we've come a long way in information sharing, because when I was carrying a gun for a living, it was all the information sharing was done with a two-way radio, and that was about it. We could talk to the other officers. We could, in fact, if we wanted to, call a dispatcher. It was before they became telecommunicators. And we talked to the dispatchers, and they would say, you know, I would run a license plate or you know, and try to get information back on a suspect if we were, like, in a high-speed chase. And, you know, they would enter something into a 3270 terminal, and I'm sure there's a few people in here that would admit they know what that is. A mainframe in Nashville would crank around for a little while, and that information on the driver would come back. And you might get that within 3 to 5 minutes. So that was about as real time as it was in those days. That was back in the late 70s, early 80s. So that was information sharing. And we sort of figured out, as far as border security for us, it was all intrastate. So what we were doing at the time That was Knox County, Tennessee. There was, inconveniently, the third largest city in the state sitting right in the middle of our jurisdiction. So if a suspect would cross over from the county into the city, we couldn't talk to those guys because they had a different frequency that on their radio system. So we figured out over time that that was an impediment. So, you know, we came to trunk land mobile radio systems where we could all talk to each other. We got mobile data terminals where we could run the license numbers ourselves. So technology, we've never been bad at sort of figuring out the technology part of this. What I've seen over time, and I think some of you would probably agree with this, is it's not the technology. When we would go to implement, like, the trunk radio system, there was always these arguments over jurisdiction and who would actually run the system and who would actually run the dispatch center for the system and how much information we could actually share, because some of the information that we would access with the mobile data terminals might not be something that the county would want to share with the city. And over time, as I've started working, you know, with the state governments and the federal governments and internationally, we see very similar issues. It's not normally the technology. We're pretty good at fixing problems with technology. It's how do we determine what we want to share and how do we control the dissemination of that once we've determined it? Do we want it to go just to the next level? For example, at U.S. Visit, one of the things we've seen with the five country code project is trying to figure out how better to communicate with our international partners, New Zealand and Australia and so forth, Great Britain, and getting better at that. You know, we can. It's the technology is part of the issue. We've sort of come around to fix that, but now it becomes more of a question of the politics around the information. Who gets the information, how far can it go? And so I think that's part of the discussion we need to have is better, better ways to sort of figure out how we collaborate with each other in terms of how we share the information and where it goes.
Great. I'm gonna go ahead. Thanks for that, Don. We'll get more into the details. I want to skip Josh, and I'm going to go off to Bob, and then we'll get Eileen, and then back to Josh.
Great. Ozzie, thanks very much. I appreciate being here. I think I hoarded my way onto this panel when I saw who was going to be here and who was on the panel. And frankly, the fact that this was co-hosted by MITRE, I just wanted to attend. And Ozzie was gracious enough to let me come here today. And just to recognize that MITRE had a great deal to do with what, you know, where we are, where U.S. Visit is today. We wouldn't be there without MITRE, so thanks to them and thanks to Ozzie. Many in this room know about what U.S. Visit is and the biometrics added to the whole border security realm, so I won't bore you with all the details, but just let me kind of just go through a litany of points here, and I'll be somewhat quick and get to the real point, which is about the international side of this. By adding biometrics to the whole visa process and port of entry process and entry process, it's just completely changed the way that we do business. And now that we have full interoperability with the FBI, the inspectors have information, the officers have information they never had before. And in four locations and soon to be all locations, that information is in real time. So the FBI can provide on primary up to 70 million records of their criminal master file. That never happened before. When I was an inspector in San Francisco many years ago, we would be stamping people in not knowing that they had criminal history information that would bar their entry into the U.S., and in more and more locations, that's going to be made available to the inspector. We'll get that with DOD at some point. We've been having some challenges with full interoperability with DOD, but we still get their data. We get it manually, so we'll be able to provide that to all of our stakeholders, too. And now that the Coast Guard has access to those same files, they've been able to vastly improve their operations at sea, mostly in the Mona Pass area and also in the Florida Straits, but increasingly they're going to be adding biometrics to their day-to-day operations. So now that the U.S. government is fairly well on its way to achieving full interoperability, we have to look at where we can grow that in the international scene. And that's where we are today. And Don just mentioned the Secure Real-Time Platform, SRTP. And what that allows is any one of the five countries, the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and ourselves, to vet their fingerprints against the holdings of any of the other four countries. And this is for visa purposes, for entry purposes, asylum purposes, or even people who are in country whose identity is not known. And that's going to, again, grow the system, because what we found was the phenomenon that was U.S. visit back in 2004 that was somewhat pilloried by a lot of the other countries is now being replicated across the globe. And so more and more countries now are changing the way that they issue visas and operate at their borders, where they're adding biometrics to that process. And that enriches all of our databases, because that information can now be shared among a greater number of countries. Now, there's also the other side of the coin. We can secure our countries much more efficiently by this information sharing protocols with these other countries, but there's also the great opportunity for facilitation. And I would never venture to speak for CBP, but their global entry program is the way of the future. And to the point where CBP and others can process some number, 51% or greater, of the traveling public, the cost efficiencies that we can realize and the effectiveness we can realize is just going to be fantastic. And more countries across the EU, across Asia, are going to this automated border control. And it's the fact that you have the biometrics that allows you to do so. You know it's Bob Mockney crossing today, so therefore either you want to put him in secondary or you can let him go. But you know for sure who that is. And the legal framework is in place to allow for that to happen. So I think the facilitation side is going to be the next big wave here. And in these kind of downturn economic times, I think it's important to look at how we use that information. And then lastly, with those two ways of handling the people, we have to look at different modalities. And down in McAllen, Texas, we're running a pilot with the chief's station down there, using iris and face to process people to see how that operates in an operational environment. We'll always have fingerprints for the base biometric to make sure that we can vet that person against the criminal holdings. But by adding face and iris, much better from a transactional standpoint. It's non-invasive. The person doesn't really have to do anything. They don't have to touch anything. And we can process a lot more people a lot more quickly. So we've seen this kind of growth from, you know, certainly the security first into the facilitation, and from kind of being by ourselves to this international area. I think the opportunities here are just fantastic. We still have to, I think, look at the protection of that information. As more and more people are providing their fingerprints across the globe, the privacy protections, all those areas, we've got to keep the public on our side. And we've been reading recently about a proliferation of biometrics, not just within border security, but across the globe. And across all vectors there, including a school down in Florida, which is taking palm prints of children's hands to pay for lunches. And some people loving it, and others saying that's a very invasive use of my child's information. So as we grow this international data sharing area, we have to look at the public's kind of acceptance of it and make sure that we're doing everything in our as best we can to keep them looking at a positive way of doing this.
Thanks, Bob. Eileen?
Thank you. First of all, we're delighted to be here today to shamelessly peddle some of the work we've been doing in this area. I wanted to just give a quick overview.
You wouldn't be the first.
I wanted to give a quick overview of where GEO has been in this issue. Back in 2005, we put the issue of terrorism-related information sharing on our high-risk list, and this is a list of programs, functions, whole agencies, or activities that, based on our look at the federal government across everything that it does, these things pose a significant liability to the nation. And so we place these on our list and continue to monitor efforts to solve problems and remove barriers in this area. So we've been doing a lot of work looking at improving sharing across agencies and the stand-up of the information sharing environment. We've been working with Sharmenda Paul and Mike Howell and those folks at the program manager's office. We've also been looking within agencies. In September, we issued a report. We did a deep dive looking at DHS information sharing within the department. And we've done a lot of work looking at sharing with state and local partners. We've done several looks at fusion centers. We have another one ongoing I'll tell you about in a minute. And we also did a review looking at information and intelligence sharing with border partners in particular. And we've done a lot of body of work on watch listing as well from an information sharing standpoint. So I sort of took a look across all of those areas, and I'm going to offer some insights from that to you this morning. Probably none of them are going to be earth-shattering or new, but probably just reinforcements of things and best practices that we know. I want to start a little differently, maybe at the tactical level. So we did take a look at, we went to work in some border communities along the northern and southern border, met with local law enforcement to talk about how can the federal government use them as eyes and ears and provide situational awareness. And we found that those worked, and this is not really news, but those worked best when they had good, effective partnerships with their federal partners in the areas, with their FBI regional offices or the FIGs, with CBP, Border Patrol folks, et cetera. Where it worked well, the federal agencies were reaching out to try to find out what these local law enforcement folks needed in terms of information. They had good partnerships. They had task forces. When they provided information to local law enforcement, they also provided feedback on how good the information was coming back from local law enforcement. We found that they had the best relationships, the chief will be glad to hear, with the Border Patrol, most likely because they had operational activities with the federal agency. Then FBI and then ICE. FBI, we found some challenges because, as you know, they argue they do investigations and they can't share information because they don't want to interrupt those investigations. They have classified information. So sometimes we found that posed some tensions in providing intelligence and information to state and local partners. So we made some recommendations to the agencies to address these issues, in particular to share best practices where these kinds of relationships and interactions were working best. At the time, the Suspicious Activity Reporting Initiative was just being rolled out, and so we were hearing from border communities they'd like more help about identifying what kinds of suspicious activities the federal government was interested in, especially in a unique border environment. They wanted a lot of help. They're operating in an all-crimes arena, and that's their bread and butter, so they needed help figuring out what was important to the federal government. We currently have a review of the Nationwide Suspicious Activity Reporting Initiative underway, and we'll be issuing a report on that in mid-February, so we're looking to see how that's working and how that's been rolled out. So I wanted to go up a level now to state and local or state and major urban area fusion centers because they also, we found, play an important role in this. And this is probably also no surprise, but fusion centers that were involved in an operational capacity with state and local and federal law enforcement, for example, Arizona with border security issues on the southwest, or Albany where they had some border security operational involvement, or in Seattle. And those centers were more mature. We found that, you know, the information sharing and intelligence support to operations, that was much healthier in those centers. In centers such as Montana, where they maybe didn't have an operational component, they weren't as mature, the federal government still had ways to go on that. These centers that had an operational component, they were generating border products and sharing that with state and local law enforcement as well as federal partners. We also found out that having federal partners from CBP, ICE, FBI, and DHS in the fusion centers itself made a huge difference in terms of information and intelligence sharing. As you all know, there's a lot of concern about the future of those fusion centers. Will they be able to develop the needed capabilities? Will they be able to sustain themselves in this budget environment? And can they demonstrate the kinds of what we're getting for our money? What results are they achieving? Just of note, we currently also have a review looking at sort of the domestic intelligence information sharing structure that's out there. So we have a review looking at fusion centers versus FBI's joint terrorist task forces versus FBI's field intelligence groups. And then you have counter-narcotics field-based intelligence centers. And then you have regional information sharing centers. All grew up for different reasons and different times, but the federal government is now taking a look across that architecture and saying what makes sense. So we'll be issuing that report in mid-February as well. Finally, at the department level, you know, the headquarters level of the federal departments, they provide things like threat assessments, especially on the northern border, help to identify gaps and strategies. There are a lot of interagency activities in place as well as interagency activities. There's been a lot of successes, but there's still also some conflicts out there. As we mentioned, DHS has a pretty robust governance structure now for their information sharing. They went through each of their missions, including border security, identified gaps, and identified priority initiatives they want to fund to fill those gaps. Whereas in another case, we found that because of overlapping statutory jurisdictions, there are some conflicts, for example, between ICE and DEA over drugs crossing the border. So the two agencies have developed a new memorandum of understanding and new partnerships to try to resolve some of these conflicts. And as you're well aware, new partners are joining this scenario with pandemic. We're bringing in the health and medical community into this realm as well. From our work on watchlisting, and I think some of our colleagues mentioned this in the earlier panel, we did note that DHS is pushing the borders further and further. And we noted that CBP has expanded its process that it was using to try to vet people before they boarded planes in foreign countries and to make their admissibility decisions and then advise the airports about whether or not a person should board a flight. So we saw that that had expanded significantly after the December Christmas Day bomber. Land border crossings still remain a challenge because we don't want to interrupt commerce, and we have 30 seconds to look at the information we have on an individual, and there's a lot of push and pull. People want to know if they're terrorists, they're criminals, they're sex offenders, they're people infected with tuberculosis. So I think a challenge here is going to be keeping the agent capability as well as our technological capabilities up to speed to be able to be all things to all people at land border crossings. We also identified that there are vulnerabilities, especially on federal lands and also on tribal lands. We still have gaps there and gaps also in physically, but also in terms of relationships and information sharing that we need to work on. Moving then up into interagency, many of you probably know that the White House created an Information Sharing and Access Interagency Policy Committee that's been up and running for several years now. It has very senior folks from across the agencies looking at these very issues. They've created a number of sub-working groups, one on watchlisting, for example, and one on border security. So we have, I think, an interagency body that can make some of these cross-agency and trade-off decisions with a little bit of teeth and authority from the administration. In terms of international partners, we noted that, again, when the U.S. was involved in joint operations with our international partners, information sharing and intelligence sharing on border issues was healthy. We also noted that there were interagency task forces, the border enforcement task forces, both on the northern border, and I think we may have some of those on the southern border. Task forces getting people together in one place also obviously enhances information and intelligence sharing around these issues, such as border issues. More MOAs and sharing agreements, as some of our colleagues talked about in our last panel. Finally, our bosses, the Congress, also have a role in this. What they legislate, obviously, and what they fund also helps to determine some of these issues and what the oversight they're going to conduct on these issues. And it's their responsibility to hold agencies accountable to plugging some of these gaps and holes as well. In terms of the resource constraints, we did note, for example, when we looked at DHS, they had identified 22 information sharing priorities and 8 critical priorities, and we had noted that funding problems were delaying 5 of their 8 critical priorities. So we were seeing real time how these budget constraints may be impacting some of these activities. As you know, the administration and OMB's position is information sharing and intelligence sharing is an integral part of anything that an agency does, so it's not a separate budget line item. And so from that perspective, these initiatives are fighting and competing with mission responsibilities. Within DHS, the components have to fund these initiatives, and they're budgeting or they're making trade-off decisions with crucial mission requirements such as more people, more technology. And then finally, the changing nature of the threat also impacts all of this. As we know, the concerns about domestic threats and homegrown terrorism have increased the interest in sort of the domestic infrastructure for these issues, and I think that that will put a new face on these border issues as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Eileen. You make me sound even more disorganized than I actually already do. That was very great, concise remarks. We appreciate that. Okay, Josh, over to you.
Thanks, Ozzie. It's really been my pleasure, just want to mention at the outset, to work with you and to work a little bit with CSIS, and really my honor to be on a panel and in a room with so many people who have so profoundly been part of the solution to our homeland security challenges since 9/11, and especially since the creation of DHS almost 10 years ago now. And I'm going to try to focus in the fairly short period of time my observations and attempt to say something that I hope will be coherent and constructive on what's a really complex set of issues, which is using intelligence and information in the border environment. And in so doing, I want to talk a bit about what I see as, and have observed as a bit of a gap still in that effort. And I think the gap, at least what I see as one, is that the intelligence and information and analysis from the intelligence community, the larger intelligence community, does not always flow down to the operational folks along the border. When I say the operational folks, I'm really talking about the operational offices, mainly at CBP, Customs and Border Protection, and ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. You can include some others as well, but sort of the center of gravity of what I'm talking about. And now, I say that with a lot of awareness that there have been tremendous improvements in these areas since 9/11. I think the creation of the TIDE, sort of integrated watch list. The U.S. visit program, by the way, has been one of the very, very best programs that's been most impactful at information sharing and in a way that really does improve the mission and make us safer. And there's a lot of credit to folks like Bob and others in the room along these lines. But that said, I still believe that there's a wealth of information in the intelligence community that does not always make it in a timely manner to the right people. And wealth, by the way, maybe being a good word to use, because not only is it a lot of information, but it's a lot of information we spend a lot of wealth developing in the IC. And it's a little bit of a shame, I think, that that isn't used in the most effective way. And the border is an area where it really could do a lot of good and doesn't. It doesn't go as far. We don't get the ROI in this environment as we might, and so what really happens? Well, one point is that the relevant information, as I said, doesn't make it down to the operators, but also I think that the intelligence community in turn doesn't fully and as clearly as they could understand what questions the operational folks on the border would like answered, that they could answer, but they don't have the questions. Another way of saying they don't have the intel requirements, really, for the operational folks on the border. So I think that's, if we can stipulate in the interest of time, that's a gap that still remains. So why? I mean, why is that? Why does that happen? Probably a lot of reasons, I think. But the reason I want to focus on for a moment is that I believe that doing intel, if you can, if I can use that sort of term, in the law enforcement environment, and specifically at DHS, is very hard. It's just a very hard thing to do. And I would actually agree with Don that it's not the technology. That can be difficult, but that's usually, relatively speaking, easier. It's hard, I think, for two sets of reasons, one of which is fairly well known and been talked about a lot, the second not as much, at least in my view. And the first set of reasons are a set of reasons that I think post 9/11 and in part of the 9/11 Commission, the very good 9/11 Commission report, talked a little bit about, if you guys remember, when they were saying, why is information not shared between the CIA and the FBI, et cetera, and there was a lot of discussion, I think it was good discussion and debate, about whether law enforcement organizations, particularly the FBI, are backwards looking because they're trying to solve crimes or find out who done it and don't look forward. I think that there was something to that debate. And that generally law enforcement, intelligence in the law enforcement environment wasn't very mature. And I think that was a productive discussion and debate, and you can have your own views on that. I do. But that's sort of one set of reasons I think is valid. I think the second set of reasons is one that has not been focused on very much, and I think in a way is sort of ironic. It's less well recognized. It's sort of an inverse of the first, which is that at least in my view, law enforcement does a tremendous amount of what really at heart is intelligence, but isn't called intelligence. They don't recognize an intelligence, they don't label it as intelligence. And that creates a little bit of a, whether it's a Mars and Venus or a hard difficulty sort of in terms of language, in terms of the operational law enforcement folks talking to the intel people. What do I mean? I'll give you at least a couple examples. In a traditional law enforcement investigated environment, say in the Homeland Security investigations at ICE, certainly they do whodunit like the FBI does, but they also do a lot of what's not backwards looking at all. Going back to the old customs days, the folks at HSI will often, if they see and they're aware of a load of drugs, for example, arriving at a port of entry or a crate of fake designer handbags, they'll seize it, or they'll help CBP seize it. But sometimes what they'll do is very clever and smart, and they will allow it to come in and follow it to find out the whole, or to be able to dismantle the whole organization. That's a core, traditional bread and butter investigative thing. But I think you could easily call that intelligence. They don't. They call that investigations. But it is an intelligence-like thing that's done. Certainly not backwards-looking. It's forward-looking. And so that's an intel function, in a sense, that does not reside in an intel shop at a law enforcement organization. It's just core investigations. And similarly, at my old agency's CBP, they do a lot of risk analysis of data analytics of things like, for example, cargo containers coming in. They do a tremendous amount of analysis of what's high risk, what's low risk, and it's not backwards looking, it's forwards looking. It's taking information, but doing analysis on it. And that's done, let me say it this way. In the military, say, for example, I'm not a military guy, but I think this is hopefully this is true, that would probably be done at a JIC, a Joint Intelligence Center or Joint Analysis Center, part of the J2, really the intelligence enterprise, the intelligence apparatus of the military. At CBP, the intel folks are involved. They have an intel office, and they're certainly part of that process. But it's really the center of gravity. It's done out of their IT shop and their Office of Field Operations. Again, a core part of their operations rather than as, quote, intel per se. So that, I think, there's a set of reasons of examples like this, and I gave a couple. And what's the result of all of this? At least in my view, I think the result is that it really complicates efforts to do intel in DHS and the law enforcement environment because the operational folks and the intel folks have a little bit more difficulty than you might think working together. And for the intel professionals, the people who are really intel professionals at DHS, and there are some very good ones, and they exist in different places, and particularly DHS INA, I think it makes it hard for them because they do not have traditional counterparts exactly to go to. It's not the J2 or the JAC or the whatever that as an intel professional, maybe you came from the IC, maybe you came from the military. You can't go to people you're used to going to and pulling the same levers and having exactly the same conversations. Even though the work is getting done, it's a little bit of an unfamiliar environment. And in turn, if you're an operational guy, you may be doing intel-like work but not see it as, quote, intel, and so you don't think to go to the, quote, intel guys at DHS, or you're not used to things like packaging your requirements, what you need in intel requirements, in language that can be consumed by the professional intel people. And so I think this whole dynamic is one that has complicated efforts at largely in law enforcement and particularly at DHS to do intelligence in a way that could help operations better. And in the interest of time, I'll wrap it up quickly, which is what does it mean? Well, I'm going to harken back to something Admiral Loy mentioned that, really, I hope smarter people than me come along and can try to wrestle with and come up with answers to these things. I'll give one modest suggestion, especially I think it might be timely because anytime you have a second term of an administration, you expect some kind of turnover, and there's an opportunity in that dynamic for people to take a fresh look at things. I think that's very healthy. And my modest suggestion would be is any of the new or even existing people at DHS are looking at the intel enterprise, if you want to call it that, to resist the temptation, and it is a real temptation, to say maturing means becoming more like the DOD or the intel community or et cetera. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I just think it's very tempting to say, if, to get better, we're going to be more like, look more like the people who we perceive have done it longer and better. And instead, sort of try to take a step back and focus on the fundamentals and say, what do you want to accomplish with the intelligence? What problems do you want to solve here? And then rather than organize your operations so that you can use the tools of information intelligence, instead try to organize your processes for disseminating that information to fit better the actual operations that are going on, and not try to reorganize things necessarily or reconfigure things that are working already in the operational sides of the agencies along the border.
Great, Josh. Thank you for those remarks. Okay, well, I'm going to ask one question. We have ample time for audience questions, but mine's going to be a little bit of a larger. The issue of information sharing and intelligence in support of our border security. Post-election, we started to have some conversation about comprehensive immigration reform, something that has been, a bridge too far for many years, but one that people say that we need to address. Now, people from the Hill, nobody laugh now. With Senator Schumer and Senator Graham coming together and saying perhaps we can find a way forward, that we look some sort of model where it's, we secure the borders and then we grant some sort of amnesty program. But the idea is that this is now being discussed as a distinct possibility. If that happens, that will certainly require legislation that will include many different things. It certainly will have a huge impact on CBP, what we do with ICE, and what we do along the border. So my question to the panelists, and Chief, you can recuse yourself from answering this if you'd like. My question is, what impact would some sort of comprehensive immigration reform legislation have on our ability to enhance information sharing and support of border security? Would it be an opportunity to maybe improve it? Would it be something that would complicate it? And I realize it's a little bit of a crystal ball question, but be interested to get your ideas since this is a conversation that we'll be having in the coming months. So, Chief, you can pass, or I'll let you have first bite, your choice.
I think I'll pass.
Okay. All right, Don, I'm going to go down the line here, then we'll go to the audience.
My initial reaction to that is, it's when you approach the whole idea of securing the border and then doing the reform. I don't want to say amnesty.
Sure. Yeah. Excuse my shorthand.
No. And so the complications would arise in several places. One is for the chief, for example, is to figure out what the new rules actually are. I mean, somebody's going to have to say that.
But let's focus on the information sharing aspect of it.
Understood. As far as the information sharing goes, the infrastructure, that you have in place is one thing. So if you're going to say, well, we're going to increase border security, so now what form does that take, right? Am I going to have to increase the number of sensors? Am I going to, what am I going to do now? Am I going to put more people on the border? So I'm going to have infrastructure to communicate with them, not just voice, but data. So am I going to hang one of these on everybody so I can start transmitting voice, video, data across that? So really the whole thing now, the reality is right now is we have not a problem as we said again, the technology, it's a big data problem, right? And I think this is only going to make it, I don't want to say worse, it's going to increase the issues surrounding this. We're going to have to start storing more information. We're going to have more data points. So we're going to have to store more of this. We're going to have to figure out how to analyze it, what we're going to do with it, and then the visualization of that and the collaboration. So now, what does the end point look like for somebody that, because this is the fellow that has to operationalize that. So that's where I think it's going to complicate it even more, is he's going to have to think of more effective ways to utilize all this information that we're gathering.
I'll go ahead and I'll let all my government folks take a pass at this question, but Josh, do you want to take that?
I'm happy to just for a moment. I mean, at the risk of stating the obvious, I think that the coming CIR possibility of a comprehensive immigration reform sort of raises the stakes in a couple ways of with the very topic we're talking about. On the one hand, you know, it's a new set of individuals that will have to be vetted for a new in a different way, and that always, anytime you want to do something new, you need to come up with ways to do it well and from an intel perspective, et cetera, and do it effectively so that the right people get the whatever benefit that's available, and the people you don't want to get it actually don't get it. And so, again, at the risk of stating the obvious, I think that there's going to be an important information sharing and intel component to something that you do from a vetting perspective. And luckily, DHS has gotten really a lot better at this in a lot of environments. I think, secondly, there's a good likelihood that that as the debate continues, I think that some people will say, well, if we're going to do this, we also want to strengthen border security. And I would myself be in favor of that. But if you're going to strengthen it, you're going to have to do it in what's probably still going to be an austere budget in environment. So people are going to have to think of ways to do better and do more, and there's going to be an interest in doing more without a ton of money available to do it. And I think that in turn raises the stakes and makes it more important to use information and intelligence more effectively, because that's a way to get some force multiplying effect without, at least hypothetically, without quite as much cost, and maybe using existing information in a way that can be done better. So I think generally CIR is going to put more focus on these questions and generally raise the stakes.
Thanks for that. We're going to go ahead and go to the audience now. Any questions from anyone in the audience? I have multiple other ones if you don't. Anyone? Okay, go up front here. All right, front. Oh, this way. The life of an intern.
Thank you. My name is Samira Daniels from Ramsey Decisions. Joshua, I think I've addressed you before. You know, you raise a very, very critical questions, and you put them in very succinct, practical ways. I think the question that I have is, who do you think, when you mention, for example, that the, you know, you have to, there's, you're going to have to face the issue of whether the Homeland Security and with respect to border control is going to be look more and more like the, you know, the another institution, for example. Who do you think is in a position to really evaluate a lot of this? Because I think that has been a big part of the problem.
I mean, I think everybody who feels that they're a stakeholder in the question who's involved probably has a role in it. I'm not sure there's anyone who is uniquely qualified or uniquely positioned to have the answer. I think it's something that is going to happen both from the inside and the outside, and among both the intel professionals within DHS and the operational folks within in DHS. And it's something that is really, at least in my view, ought to be coordinated at the department level. That's the reason you have a department to coordinate sort of questions like this. But it can't be answered in any one spot, nor should, I think, DHS try to answer it alone. But to their credit, I don't think they do try to answer things alone. I think they do think the department is actually decent at trying to reach out to folks. And luckily, there are people like Ozzy and CSIS that are, provide a forum for people to have this dialogue. So I don't have a smart, unfortunately, I don't have a better or smarter answer to the question. It's, well, a very good
yeah,
one.
Yeah, let me ask the government folks this question then a little bit differently. You know, the idea, and it's not, and Josh, you brought up some good points with the information and intelligence sharing inside the Department of Homeland Security in general, probably is, you know, epitomized very much so by what happens in it, you know, organization like CBP, and it's, you know, great to hear the example to F3EA, having spent some time down and it's SOCOM, where this model, Understand Crystal, was actually used by the military. It's great to see that being transferred to a different part of the department. But not everything is applicable, for sure. We say, you know, we don't want DHS to operate like the CIA. We don't want DHS to operate like DOD. Different, totally different issues. But with that said, there is a need, a very clear need, to enhance this information sharing and I don't call it intelligence, call it information sharing in support of our operational elements of Department of Homeland Security. What What is the number one or primary impediment that you see? That is it an authorities issue? Is it a budget issue? Is it a technology issue? And you don't have to get into specifics, but just generally speaking, you know. So I'll start with you, Chief. Is it, you know, I don't have the money I need, I don't have the authorities I need, or I just need to continue to break down? It's going to take time to break down cultures.
Well, I think for me, and certainly looking at this from about 26 years, and certainly as we looked at reframing the way that we look and do border security in this new strategy, one thing, just think about it, and I'm just talk as a cop, right? You have, just within the Department of Homeland Security, two different entities, right? You have investigators, you have interdictors. Interdictors are those at and between the ports of entry. People are coming. We have to make go, no-go decisions on things that we have no advance information in many respects. You have investigators that are gathering case files. They are preparing things for court. And I've used this analogy before. So you have, picture in front of this table, you have a bunch of pocket trash, maps, handwritten drawings, and diagrams. If you brought in an ICE investigator and said, what does this mean to you? And an ICE investigator, because of the way he or she has been trained, right, will come up and say, well, geez, this is great information. This is either case lead or this is part of information on an open case. And because of the rules of evidence and because of the potential disclosure of this, I have to take that, put it into my file, don't share it with anybody, preserve the evidence, and figure out where this investigation is going to lead. Doesn't mean that that ICE agent is bad and doesn't want to share information. That's just the way the investigators have been trained and the ways that some of our jurisprudence is set up. If you bring in a Border Patrol agent and ask he or she what that is, well, this is information that's going to drive our deployments tonight because this may tell us exactly where that load's going to cross or where that vulnerability exists. And then somewhere lurking where we're trying to pull in, since the 9/11 Commission, the intelligence folks, right? We have to fundamentally get better at understanding that interdiction and investigation and intelligence can no longer be mutually exclusive. And I don't necessarily think that there's an aversion to doing that. But they're just somehow, when you look at investigators, and I've talked to them, not just within DHS, when you ask them, how is your performance review set up? Well, geez, I get better grades on my performance review if I do two or three major cases, as 80% to 90% of that effort is only mine, right? And so we go through a model within law enforcement that suggests that we need to hunt for Mr. Big and then take it for two or three years and preserve all that evidence. But all the while, there's information that's being collected that may or may not be prevalent in a successful prosecution that could also be used of value for interdictors or intelligence. I think it's more of, like I said, it's not necessarily technology. It's the institution and the cultures within law enforcement and being able – that's why I think in part of this joint targeting team that I mentioned earlier, because the other thing that we have to get away from, at least in law enforcement, is you can take any one of these tables and pretend that you are heads of different departments forward, right? Some of you are investigators, some of you are the intel components, and some are interdictors. And you're either at one end of the spectrum affiliated with a group that has agreed as part of a coalition of the willing, right? You're going to move beyond the Monday coffee and donuts, and you're going to maybe share a little bit. Still a little bit of risk involved. You're not sure. And at the other end, you may have a unified command. But somewhere within that dynamic, as you start building that trust and building that relationship, one of you is going to lose equity because there's a decision that's going to have to be made, because as part of that process and the maturation, you're going to identify that there are, within the theater of operation, which all of you govern, there are specific goals and objectives that you want to accomplish for the overarching border security effort. But at some point in time, someone's going to be asked to give up a couple more Border Patrol agents, or you're going to be asked to put an investigator to this task force that you don't own. And all of a sudden, all of us start get back into our silos and say, I'd love to do that, but my boss back in Washington expects me to do this. And so what happens is that decision gets deferred because it starts rippling at the trust that's been built in those relationships. So all of the real impacting hard decisions never get made. We just continue to go back and do at the edges what we consider joint operations, right? Or we talk about we're cooperating and coordinating in the field. Well, there's a difference, and that's the reason why we talk about integration, because you have to be able to integrate. And what that means is within the theater of operation, taking the same goals and objectives against common threats and be able to execute independent of who gets credit for that. And that's more of a cultural change within three different pipes of investigators, interdictors, and intelligence folks, and then the command staff recognizing that we're not worried about who gets the credit, and we're not going to no longer just look back retrospectively and hold up our pictures of dopes and apprehensions and everything else and suggest that, we're somehow transformative in our approach to border security, because it's never worked, in my estimation.
Great. Thanks for that answer. We'll go ahead and go over to Rob.
Rob Cortell, and this is addressed at Eileen. Eileen, you're the purported third party, objective third party here. In all the studies you've done over the last couple years, how would you rate all of the agencies and components here? Where are the holes? What's working really well gets an A. What's working less well gets a C.
Let me focus that for you. Rob is a man of big vision. Can we just focus on the DHS entities, the Homeland Security Enterprise, so maybe CBP, ICE, Coast Guard?
Well, we actually have a job we just kicked off looking at the DHS Intelligence Enterprise, so we've just made a round with all the components. We're looking at the Office of Intelligence and Analysis and its role in trying to bring this enterprise together. And I think it was interesting you mentioned, one issue is authority. I mean, INA doesn't necessarily have authority over the components, so it has to bring them to the table, worry about equities, and try to, work with them and facilitate the better sharing of information. So I think within the department, there is support, leadership support to do this. They've established an intelligence council, some working groups. They're now developing a joint program of analysis, so they vet all the components, requirements, and intelligence questions that need to be answered, and they're all agreeing on those priorities. So we're seeing things happen within the department in the intelligence area. We learned a lot just from our initial meetings with the components, because folks like CIS, USCIS, who we thought might not have a huge role, end up having some very unique information and intelligence they collect, and the department is recognizing that now and learning to leverage and share, what they have among the components and outside of DHS as well. So I don't know that we're ready to grade all the components at this point, but see us in about 6 or 8 months.
Okay, no advertisements. Okay.
Thanks. Chris Perhaney, independent consultant. Given the fiscal and budget environment we're headed towards for the next decade or so, it begs the question that we need a paradigm shift into something that we don't do well of in this country, because we have a policy aversion to it called public-private partnerships. Now, let me recast it in the sense of what we've heard in the news for last year. There's $1.6 to $1.8 trillion sitting in corporate profits that are not invested. Let's suppose that 3% of those, very small number, were applicable to border security. That's $48 to $54 billion. Now, you know how the government normally does something for a government use application? Right. Okay, bottom line, if there was a way to leverage $50 billion of corporate investment by allowing a corporate entity to resell the solution that they helped you buy to other nations that increase their border security and ultimately ours, is that something that your agencies would be interested in thinking about, talking about, and as a policy change?
Anyone want to take that one? Bob, I'll let you. You've been quiet. This is your penalty for
for getting up here. I think we see some areas where we certainly have a strong partnership with the industry, the IT industry, and getting the requirements out there. I mean, some of the devices that we use didn't exist until we put that requirement out there and it was created for us. I talk about the cross-matched fingerprint device that we use. With respect to my particular area here, there is talk of identity banks, the growing use of biometrics in other areas, and companies offering, their as a service, basically. So it would be identity as a service, where you can enroll with a particular organization, and then that information can be used by a bunch of different entities. We are talking about that with respect to the five countries. So this, why should we capture 10 prints, you know, in Australia, in the U.S., in Canada, and the U.K. every single time, and why not do it once and then have the information being used in multiple different venues? And so in a sense of – and then again, there I talked about the application with, you know, the kids in Florida. This idea of identifying people with biometrics is a growing phenomenon, and the extent to which the private industry can get into that and build these systems, you know, in the cloud, as it were, is an area that we've been talking about. But that would be it, I guess, in my particular area.
Okay, great. Any other, you can go if nobody else is around, Rob. Anyone else have any questions? Rob Zitz, go ahead. Great. Can you use the microphone just for the webcast, folks?
Just the comment on the budget. So what, flat will be the new up over the next decade. There's already, we've been talking about information sharing and information sharing between DOD, the intelligence community, and DHS. What about technology sharing? Some of that's gone on, obviously, over the last decade. Predator B is an example with CBP. But do you see or forecast in the next 10, 15 years more opportunities to take technologies where we've already burned down the risk in the intelligence community and in DOD and transferring them into your mission space?
Yes. As a matter of fact, last year, in recognizing that the potential with the military drawdown overseas, there may be some dual-use technology that we could apply towards our primary border security mission. Working with the committees, given their support, and working up a memorandum of understanding between the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense, we're in the process now of identifying those. It used to be back in the day, you know, guys like me would sit out at the DRMO until they opened up, kind of like the Black Friday, and wait till it opened and with a bucket full of ball caps and some coins, and we used to, you know, go through, you know, what we were able to find, and but we've come a long way and recognize that there are things that the taxpayers have already paid for, that we recognize that instead of sitting in some boneyard or perhaps in a warehouse, that we can go ahead and augment the great work that the appropriators have generously given us some additional technology over the years, and we can augment that. And we have been actually experimenting over the years, working with whether it was National Guard or Title 10 forces in terms of those types of emerging technologies to identify those in advance so that we have a better sense of things that we already know work versus those that we would just as soon not use. But we're in the process of doing that, and we'll continue to do so over the next few years.
Did you spend time in San Diego? The DRMO down there. Go ahead, Bob.
Just real quick, I think in the area of analyzing big data, we're amassing a huge amount of information on individuals. We have 148 million individual records in IDENT. We've got ADIS, which is the biographic side of the house, which has trillions of encounter data in there. Every time we see someone, everything that happens to them. How do you process that? What does that mean to have that data, and how can we use that more effectively? So I think analyzing big data would be one.
You know, the other thing we see is under the information sharing environment and the White House Council, we see the Office of the Director of National Intelligence becoming more involved, and so that they're doing a lot within that community that they're trying to leverage for the stakeholders and partners outside of the classified environment and outside of the IC community. So, and then the program manager is also doing a lot to try to develop standards that will affect acquisitions and to leverage as much as possible what's already out there to take advantage of investments already made.
All right, Rob, you're dissatisfied with the first answer. Last real quick question. Go ahead.
Different tech, but it's on intelligence gathering and information sharing. Pretty soon we're going to have dossiers on 370 million Americans sitting in DHS when you're finished. And probably another 2 million people are going to have access to it, not counting the people who can hack it. I know we're the good guys, but Morsi says he's a good guy too. So is this a good thing or a bad thing?
We should just leave that question for introspection, shouldn't we? you know what? Don is chomping at the bit. I'll give him last word, and then we'll go ahead and take our break.
So whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing, I mean, it's a thing, right? I mean, you have to understand it's part of the mission, and we are collecting it. I think someone does, though, to your point, I think have to start thinking about the rules of how we control access to this. For example, we're doing similar things for Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services with the insurance exchanges and so forth. We're doing identity proofing. And so when you talk about how you're doing identity management, for example, internationally, the challenge here, for example, is we can't move forward with that because the way we're doing identity proofing is asking, calling one of the credit bureaus, calling out to their system, and coming back with information based on the answers to these out-of-wallet questions. You know, you have a mortgage, you know, what's the address where the mortgage is supposed to be, the house is supposed to be, and things like that. And so Congress has determined that some of these questions were actually offending some people, and so we can't really move forward with that. So somebody has to sit down, and some group of people, I don't know if it's Congress or some Blue Ribbon Committee, and we sort of figure out how these rules start to apply, and then we can begin from a technology perspective to ratchet down that access, because you're right, you don't want 2 million people to have the ability to go access this data, because it's not just those data elements that you're worried about, it's the metadata that I can create by putting them together. So your point is well made, but we just need to get the rules right.
Okay, well, I want to really thank our esteemed panel. I particularly want to thank, you know, Chief Fisher for being a panelist and for coming out today, and everyone else here. I know your schedules are very busy. And, Bob, great to see you, Eileen, and Don, and Josh. I'm going to dual hat here real quick. We are going to do lunch, so when we conclude, please go get your meals as quickly as you can and come back to your chairs. We're going to start the next panel while you're doing that, so please keep it down if you can. And, again, I want to thank everyone for participating. Okay, we're going to start in about 3 minutes. If you're in line, take your time. Just move to your seat quietly. Those of you that already have your meals, if you could start heading to your seat. If you're a panelist and you want to eat during your panel, you can do that as well. I can't have hungry panelists. But I am patting myself on the back for having the cyber panel after lunch. I'm deleting all the hate tweets from my email account. All right. Okay, Evan Wolf, another CSIS senior affiliate, is going to moderate this panel.